Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. I'm John Payer. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. And the two issues I want to concentrate on this morning are, first, did the complaint fairly raise the issue that the loan was void ab initio? And second, did the evidence support those allegations and create an issue of fact? So first, the complaint did allege a 480 violation against the original lender, and this court's decision in Compton versus Countrywide is determinative of the issues herein. In Compton, the court employed a detailed analysis of Chapter 480 and, citing Hawaii Community Federal Credit Union versus KECA, said there are three elements to a 480 claim. One, a violation of 480-2. Two, injury to the consumer caused by the violation. And three, resulting damage. Two of the three elements are uncontested. That is, Compton held that a borrower is a consumer, and the complaint alleged also that Cabrina was a consumer who suffered injury. That's in paragraph 40, 83, and 85 of the complaint, excerpt 235-240. And second, plaintiff alleged damage, quote, in an amount to be proved at trial, end quote, in paragraph 83 and 85, excerpt 240. That's sufficient under Compton. She also alleged specific damage in that Express Capital charged her a yield spread premium of $10,718 and also charged an interest rate of 7.875 instead of the 1% advertised and represented.
Okay, how was she misled?
Well, she was misled in two ways, Judge Bybee. She, first, she was misled because the loan application that was filled out by the broker and approved by the original lender, Express Capital, showed a 1% annual 1% interest rate. The final rate was 7.875, and the APR was 8. Yes.
Counsel, here's my difficulty with that. There was a document that used the 1% rate and would support your argument in an evidentiary way. But on the date that the mortgage was signed, if I'm reading the record correctly, a correct truth in lending disclosure statement accompanied that gave, a higher annual percentage rate, 8.071, and showed the large payments and so forth. So if a misleading document is given to her on August 1st, but she gets a correct document 3 days later, what are we to make of that? Can a reasonable person rely on the earlier document?
That's a great question, Judge Graber. And a reasonable consumer would be misled, and the Compton case said exactly that, citing KECA.
But why would a reasonable consumer be misled if after 3 days they get the corrected information in their hands?
Because that's what the – and it was more than 3 days. The original loan application also showed a 1% interest.
Is that an application with Enlo or is that an application with Express?
Well, it's an application that Enlo created and was approved by Express.
You have a truth in lending disclosure. So Judge Graber's referred this to two truth in lending disclosure statements.
Right.
One is issued on August 1st, one is issued on August 4th. One shows the 1%, one shows 8%. But the first one was created by Enlo. It doesn't mention Express anyplace on it.
But we've alleged that Enlo was an agent of Express Capital. Also,
does your argument depend on being able to prove that?
No, because.
Okay, then where did Express Capital mislead the?
Because they approved the application that showed a 1% loan. They gave a earlier truth in lending disclosure showing a 1% loan, and the good faith estimate showed a 1% loan. So only the last one showed the 8% APR. So what happens is, why there was a difference is they were sucking her in. This was a bait and switch, and this is exactly what Compton says.
The premise of your question is leading me to the dust, because the 1% truth in lending statement, you keep calling it the June 1 statement, and up on on the top, forgive me, I mentioned it, August 1, and on the top of it, there's a typewritten media fax date of June 9, 2006, but the actual signature line to me looks like she dated it 5-1-06. Is this what you're, when you're thinking that the 5 is sort of a blob? It's kind of hard in handwriting to tell, but it doesn't look to me like an 8. But is this document you're describing as the August document?
Yeah, I think so, Judge.
Is your theory that she had this in June and signed it August 1?
If you look at the complaint, they sent out an advertisement back in the beginning saying 1%. They then did the loan application showing 1%. They then had the good faith estimate showing 1%, and then at the last minute they switched to 8%. This is typical of...
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, when you say at the last minute, that's what I'm trying to get at. A minute ago, Judge Graber was describing these documents, I think consistent with you, as being signed 3 days apart.
Right.
I'm sure they weren't signed months apart, and maybe it doesn't matter, but that's what I'm trying to...
Well, I think it does. I think you're right. It does matter if it was earlier. To be honest, I'm not positive either.
Okay.
But there were representations made all along the way that it was a 1% loan, and Compton deals with that exactly.
Okay. So again, before you go to Compton.
Okay.
Even if let's say this blob of a date, that number is an 8-1, is your theory that she received this back in June? Whether she signed it or not at that time? You're talking about her being sucked in, and I'm just trying to make sure I'm following your...
I'm not sure, frankly, when she received that particular document. I don't know. She had died before before the complaint was filed. But she was... It was advertised from day one that this was a 1% loan, and all of the documents until the last one said that. And Compton... citing Keka, says that a simple allegation that the rate was misrepresented during the loan negotiations is sufficient to state a 482 claim. And that's exactly what we have here, whatever dates you use.
Counsel, you keep referring to they, and I'm not sure who they is. If they is Enloe, as it is in some documents, or they is Ress, which is in other documents. I asked you whether you told me that they were in privity or that they were connected, that one was the agent for the other. I asked you if your argument depended on that, and you told me no. But you keep using the word they, so now I don't know who you're talking about.
Well, I'd say the argument is helped by that, but it doesn't depend on that. The complaint...
They have to be very precise in telling you who misrepresented what.
Well, they both did.
But these documents aren't issued by them jointly. They're issued by one party or the other. So if your argument doesn't depend on you showing an agency relationship, then you have to be very precise in telling me who misrepresented what and when.
The complaint says, quote, the yield spread premium was compensation for arranging a higher interest rate than Cabrina could otherwise have qualified for, thus benefiting both the lender and mortgage broker to the detriment of Cabrina. It also says, quote, the terms of the loan, the misrepresentation of plaintiff's income, the failure to give plaintiff documents, and the excessive charges, including the yield spread premium, rendered the loan null and void ab initio under Chapter 480. That's in paragraph 83. The former quote was paragraphs 38 and 39. It's just.
Yeah, and low in front of us now. They've been settled out. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So, tell me where Express Capital misled Ms. Cabrina.
They approved the. First of all, we did allege that they were an agent, and
right,
Charles Wheeler.
Aside for one.
Okay. Yes, Judge.
Your argument doesn't depend on that.
It helps, but I don't think it depends on that. No, they approved the loan application. They approved the good faith estimate. They had all this in front of them. It's not like they're blind. This is the kind of thing that led to the financial crisis in 2008. Express Capital.
Do they have both of the truth and lending statements, the 1% and the, I'll say, 8%?
Yes, they had everything. And you can see that from Charles Wheeler's declaration.
Is it your theory that the two truth and lending act statements
Yes. Yes, that plus all of the other. Again, Compton says if you misrepresent the rate in a loan negotiation, that's a 480 violation. They did that not only, yes, you're right, they did that with the truth in lending statements. They did that with a good faith estimate. They did that with both loan applications. And they did that with the initial advertisement.
I guess I'm having trouble seeing where Express Capital itself did those things.
Well, if you read...
So can you give me a page number to the citation to the record where it did something wrong?
Charles Wheeler says that the evidence that the broker and lender were agents and joint venturers and that they charged exorbitant fees at the expense of Mrs. Cabrina.
Yeah, that's your agency argument. I keep asking you this question, and I keep getting different answers. So.
Well, I'm saying that is an important argument. It's not the only argument.
Whether your argument depends on it or not. If it doesn't depend on that, then I hope you'll answer Judge Graber's question, which is, where are the documents in which Express misrepresented the loan?
Hey. I think that the joint venture argument is an important argument and does cover that. Separately, I think even without that, there are documents in there because all of those documents...
What page where Express says something wrong? Because at page 158, they give... correct information on the truth in lending disclosure, Express does, and that's the same date the mortgage was signed. But so it would help me if you gave us a page or pages where other representations were made by Express, if there were any.
Excerpt 117 in Mr. Wheeler's declaration. And excerpt 103-4 in Ms. Saliga's declaration. I'm running out of time, but...
Wheeler's declaration is not evidence in and of itself of what Express did. It's an analysis of it.
Well, it's an analysis, and it says...
Can you give us a document that Express issued to her that misrepresents the loan?
The document... The documents are that they approved the loan application, two loan applications showing 1%, that the first truth in lending disclosure, which they knew of and had, they had all of these documents in their file. They can see. They're underwriters.
They're all issued by
Enloe. So what? Well, I understand that, but they're issued by Enloe, but they're in the loan file.
Enloe's not the lender.
But they're in the loan file, and the lender is responsible for reviewing the documents in its own file.
Isn't it also responsible for correcting any misimpressions, and isn't that what it tried to do with the corrected truth in lending document?
They corrected that at the very last minute when she's signing. I mean, you know how these work. You get 200 pages of documents, sign here, sign here, sign here, sign here. They've told her 1% all this time, and then she's signing.
Can you just give me one document prior to the truth in lending disclosure statement signed on August 4th in which Express Capital has told her that they are going to approve a loan of 1%?
They have approved the documents that were in their...
Well, page 82 is where the uniform residential loan application starts, and it does say, I think it says 1% on there.
And if I may
be wrong about that.
But it does. Excerpt 134. Excerpt 134, the good faith estimate. Yes, it's issued by Enloe, but it's in their file. And I want to get quickly to the, before I run out of time, to the yield spread premium argument, because that was a charged by the lender. It was a kickback to the broker for arranging a rate higher than she should have received in the first place. So she paid $10,700 to get a higher rate than she should have otherwise qualified for. And that's also specifically alleged in our complaint, and that's also a 480 violation. Compton is very clear that any kind of negotiation up to the loan that misrepresents the interest rate is a violation. The yield spread premium is just a horrible thing. They charge you $10,700 to get a higher rate than you should qualify for, and the lender and the broker split that fee. It's a kickback, and as shown clearly by Mr. Wheeler. So these claims were alleged and proved, and there is clearly a 480 violation, clearly a question of fact as to whether there's a 480 violation. And Judge Bybee, to the extent that agency is necessary, it was alleged and it was proved, and Mr. Wheeler has shown that.
What's your best evidence for agency? Just the fact that there was a premium.
There was a kick. Enlo got $24,000, almost 4% of the loan, for doing almost nothing. And most of that was a kickback for arranging a higher rate than she would have gotten.
Was there a discussion between Ms. Cabrina and Enlo that Enlo would underwrite this loan? Did she ever under the impression that Enlo itself was going to underwrite the loan?
Not that I'm aware of.
Or to someone else?
Not that I don't know, but I'm not aware of that.
We've used a lot of your time with questions, so we'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you so much.
We'll hear from Ms. Tanaka.
Good morning, Your Honors. If I may just very briefly address the cases that counsel had brought to the panel's attention in January, if I might just briefly touch on those three cases. The first one is he cites Schmidt for the proposition that the discovery rule, not the transaction rule, is a standard in Hawaii for determining when the statute of limitation runs on a claim. And I want to point out to the court that Schmidt is not a UDAP case. It's a Fraudulent Transfer Act case. And it does not, in that case, the court did say that the limitation period begins on the date that the plaintiff discovers that the transfer was fraudulent. So that's what Schmidt stands for. But it doesn't alter the standard in Hawaii for determining when the statute of limitations begins to run for a UDAP claim. And if we take
I'm not sure why that matters, because if the mortgage contract was void at the time it was entered into, then selling that to another party doesn't revive the validity of the contract, at least as I understand Hawaii law.
I understand it, Your Honor. And there's a statute, HRS 480-24. It clearly states that any action to enforce the cause of action arising under this chapter, which includes the 480-12 claim, shall be barred unless commenced within 4 years after the cause of action accrues. And under Hawaii law, the 4 years is from the date of the incurrence of the violation, not the discovery of the violation. And we have case law that says, here in this case, since plaintiff is alleging that the violation stems from the loan origination process, then the violation must have occurred at least by the time she signed the mortgage document, which was August 4th, 2006, because that's the date that she became contractually bound to the terms of the loan that she's now claiming it was obtained by unfair and deceptive means. So the trigger date is the date of the loan, August 4th, 2006. In this case, she did not file her complaint until May 18, 2011, and that's 5 years later. So if nothing else, her Chapter 480 claim is time-barred. I want to touch briefly on Compton, because that certainly is a case that plaintiff seems to be relying heavily on. I just want to point out that Compton is not on all fours. It is procedurally and factually distinct from our case. Compton involved a motion to dismiss, and in that case, the court said that plaintiff had nudged her UDAP claim across the line from conceivable to plausible. What we have here is a summary judgment motion, not a motion to dismiss. And here the plaintiff has to do more, much more than just simply nudge her claim across the line. And she did not do that. Now, the last case that plaintiff cites the supplemental case is Johnson. That's a due process violation case. And there the court did say that the complaint should not be dismissed for an imperfect statement of their legal theory. However, the court did say in Johnson that you need to plead facts sufficient so that plaintiff's claims are at least, as they called it, substantive plausibility. And in this case, as the trial court found, plaintiff's complaint lacked the factual underpinnings to maintain a 480-12 claim against the bank defendants. The declaration of Ms. Saliga, which is, I'm using the numbers that are on the bottom of the submission, the record is 0104, paragraph 18. Ms. Saliga clearly states that it was Andrew Shirley, one of the defendants that had been settled with, that filled out the loan application. So the bank certainly had nothing to do with the loan application process. And the only allegation that's in the complaint.
At what point did Ms. Cabrina realize that that it was going to be, what is it, Enterprise? Express, I'm sorry, was going to be the lender rather than Enlo. She had the impression that Enlo was going to be the lender here?
You know, I don't know, but based on her declaration, I'm assuming so, because all of it, the complaint and her declaration, is filled with statements about how they basically, Enlo Enterprises and Parker, sucked her into this. And in fact, after the loan, caused her to invest the funds into a scam investment.
Can you explain the discrepancies between the two truth and lending disclosure statements that we have in the record?
I really can't, Your Honor, because, of course, my client is not the original lender, so I have no idea why there is that discrepancy. Point being, I'm sorry?
It seems very unusual that there be two of them, and particularly unusual that they're signed on different dates. Is there anything in the record that explains that?
I don't believe there is anything in the record that explains it, other than it has been corrected. She did get the truth in lending statement. To the extent that there was a problem with a TILA claim, that's time-barred as well. It's anywhere from 1 to 3 years that has come and gone. But the point is that she was aware of it at the time, and quite frankly, she paid the mortgage.
Is the truth in lending disclosure statement, is that something that's typically issued on the day that you sign all the rest of the documents? Is that something you get in advance?
I'm not sure, but I would assume it is.
She signs all the loan documents on August 4th. Is that correct?
I don't know when she signed the documents. I really have no idea. I believe the Enlo defendants were with her, or at least somehow connected with the signing. I'm not sure. I do know that the loan date is August 6th, so my guess would be that it was signed somewhere around that period of time.
So if she doesn't receive a correct truth in lending disclosure until the date of the loan, does it fulfill its purpose of giving notice and time to think about it?
I believe it does, Your Honor. There's a time period after she receives it within which she could have said, wait a minute, that's not what I understood, that's not what I agreed, I don't want to do the loan. There is that time period that she could have done that, and she didn't do it.
So even though, here's a statute of limitations question about Hawaii law. The statute of limitations prevents a suit from being brought more than 4 years after the offense has occurred. But what happens when it is pleaded as a defense? Let's say the other side of the other contracting party comes in to get money on a contract that was void initially. Can that be raised as a defense that the contract was void, even if the time otherwise has expired? Do you understand my question?
Is the question that can a subsequent investor of the loan
No, it's a generic question about Hawaii law and about the statute of limitations. I can't come in and say 10 years after the fact, I want to stop paying on something because 10 years ago I was deceived into signing it. But what about the reverse situation? 10 years later, the other contracting party sues me. Can I raise as a defense that I've been paying on a void contract all this time and no, you can't get any more out of me?
I don't believe you can, Your Honor. I think this.
What case says that?
Well, I don't know that that precise fact pattern has presented itself to the court, but there are cases that talk about specifically 480-12 claims and how it is.
But this is a defense in my hypothetical.
Right, and I'm not aware of it being used as a defense. I can cite you to Reyes versus R-E-Y-E-S versus HSBC Bank. I only have the Westlaw site. It's 2015 Westlaw 3476371. And, I leave it at that. Reyes versus HSBC Bank USA. Oh, I'm sorry. That's the case that talks about when the statute of limitation begins to run on a 480-12 claim.
But see, that's not relevant to my question. I'm looking at 480-12, which says that it skips some words, but it says any contract in violation of this chapter is void and is not enforceable. So that's just that wording suggests to me that defensively it might be usable forever, as distinct. So if you're the other side of a void contract, you can't enforce it. It does, you know, so it's, anyway, if there are no cases, there are no cases, but.
Well, I'm not aware of it. I do believe that Chapter 480-1224 is very clear about the enforcement side of it.
Well, it's clear about the plaintiff side, but it's not clear about the defensive use.
Well, I would imagine that it should apply for the defense as well, use of it, because otherwise it would sort of erode the point of the statute, which is to cut the claims off after a certain period of time. And if you can't enforce it because they can say, statute doesn't apply to me because I'm using it as a defense, then how does that work? It makes no sense to me. I'm not aware of any particular cases.
Well, it makes sense to me, I guess, maybe in this sense, that a party can voluntarily agree to continue on the course of a contract that could have been void, but then change their mind. And I guess you're saying that this limitation covers it all because of the need to, you know, not have stale claims or whatever. But it could make sense either way, it seems to me.
Yeah, and again, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I'm not aware of any cases on the defense side, so I just don't know. If I may touch just briefly, Your Honor, on the motion to deny plaintiff's motion to amend, just very briefly. It's true that the parties were engaged in a settlement discussion, but as we all know, as litigators, you know, settlements are never certain. You never know if you're actually going to settle or not. And meanwhile, the pretrial deadlines start to march on. And I think it would have been prudent for the parties. Parties still have to comply with the court's order, even if you're engaging in settlement negotiations. And if you're looking down the road and see these deadlines coming up, appropriate motions could have been filed to move the deadlines off in light of the fact that the parties were engaged in settlement negotiations. And here, none of that occurred. Both the magistrate and the trial court found that there was no good cause to alter or amend the scheduling, the Rule 16 scheduling conference order. We listed in our brief at pages 24 and 25 all the ways and reasons why we felt that plaintiff was not acting, it was dilatory in seeking the amendment, and I won't repeat it here. But the point, Your Honor, is that the plaintiff has managed to not make mortgage payments for over 7 years. And at this point, we are asking that the court affirm the trial court's rulings so that the banks can finally get paid. If you have any further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
I don't believe that we do. Thank you. Mr. Fair, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you.
The yield spread premium that we discussed before was not disclosed in the Truth in Lending Statement or anywhere else until the HUD 1 came out. And again, you can see this from Charles Wheeler's declaration, which should be looked at very closely. The HUD 1 came out after the loan had closed, and that's where monies are dispersed, and that's the first time the yield spread premium was shown to anybody. So clearly that... Did you know what?
That's money up front, right? This money that's coming out of the...
The yield spread premium is charged to her, and again was the kickback to the broker. But it wasn't disclosed anywhere until the HUD one after the loan was already finished. So she'd signed and money was dispersed, and then it showed up. Secondly, if the paragraphs 38, 39, 83, and 85 of the complaint set forth the 480 claim, including the yield spread premium and excessive charges and so on. And so the complaint clearly set forth a Chapter 480 claim, and the evidence showed, Charlie Wheeler's affidavit declaration showed that those items were correct.
What is your response to the statute of limitations?
Okay, argument? I'm glad you asked. First, that wasn't raised or ruled on by the trial court.
And it wasn't raised or it wasn't ruled on?
Neither. I don't believe it was argued in the trial court, and it wasn't ruled on.
Was it in the pleadings or was it in the summary judgment?
Might have been
papers?
In the pleadings. I don't think it was in the summary judgment motion. I don't believe. And more importantly, to your point, Judge Graber, that in KEDA, beneficial Hawaii versus KEDA, the court said, and I quote, void means an instrument or transaction that is wholly ineffective, inoperative, and incapable of ratification, and which thus has no force or effect, so that nothing can cure it. And the court went on to say it's unenforceable at law and in equity. So if nothing can cure it, the mere passage of time can't cure it either.
No, but there is a statute of limitations, and you are the one who filed the complaint, so... Presumably, as the plaintiff, you would have to meet the statute of limitations.
The statute of limitations talks about an affirmative claim under 480.13. This is a claim that the loan was void ab initio, and as the Hawaii Supreme Court said, nothing can cure it. And in the Schmidt case, it's quite clear now, which... Yes, it wasn't a 480 case, but it's similar. It's under the UFTA, and the discovery rule, not the occurrence rule, is the law in Hawaii anyway. And the court basically held, that it doesn't make any sense to hold that somebody who didn't know of something had to raise it before they found out about it. And in answer to your question about whether it can.
What is the triggering event for the statute of limitations?
When somebody would reasonably know what the violation...
Would she reasonably have known?
She would not reasonably know until she saw an attorney.
There are no cases that talk about that. Are there in Hawaii,
yes,
as opposed to
yes,
being on notice of the facts that would cause a reasonable person to know? I mean, she had something in hand that said 1%, and suddenly she's faced with something that says 8%, and why isn't that sufficient to put a reasonable person on notice that there's a problem right then?
Even if that's correct, that wouldn't apply to the yield spread premium. Because
when was that HUD 1
issued? HUD 1 was issued shortly after.
So still more than 4 years before the filing of the complaint? Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But nobody would know. No reasonable consumer would know what a yield spread premium is.
But they know the difference between 1% and 8%.
Yes, but they don't know what the yield spread premium is. That's separate.
How much your monthly payments were going to be.
Oh, yes. That's true.
They go up.
Okay.
They told her they were going to go up, and they told her they were going to go up dramatically.
Well, at that point, after she had been deceived. Yes, yes.
So why isn't that the moment that she should have known that something was badly amiss?
She should have known. She might have. You might be able to say she should have known something was amiss with part of the loan. She would have no idea what the yield spread premium was, nor that it was a kickback to the brokers. Nobody would know that. No consumer would know that. That's a fairly esoteric charge, and it was hidden. And there are cases that talk about that in Hawaii. The Schmidt case does talk about why the discovery rule and not the occurrence rule applies, and it goes into that. There's also Kawanoe versus Hawaii Community Federal Credit Union. I don't have the site here, but it's K-A-U-A-N-O-E, and it's a truth in lending case. And the Hawaii courts said that you can raise that as a defense in response to a claim, even though the one-year statute of limitation has passed. And they did talk about the reason being that you don't necessarily know that you have a problem.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate very much the arguments from both of you in this interesting and challenging case, and the case is submitted. That is our only argued case for this morning's docket, so we will be adjourned.
Thank you.